to our side. I have almost no memory of him until 5 years later, when I am 15, and he bursts into my life at a critical moment. By then, we are strangers. It would be many years before I would understand what leaving that day had cost him, and how little he had understood about where he was going. Tony and Sean had left the mountain, but they'd left to do what my father had taught them to do: drive semis, weld, scrap. Tyler stepped into a void. I don't know why he did it, and neither does he. He can't explain where the conviction came from or how it burned brightly enough to shine through the black uncertainty. But I've always supposed it was the music in his head, some hopeful tune the rest of us couldn't hear, the same secret melody he'd been humming when he bought that trigonometry book or saved all those pencil shavings. Summer waned, seeming to evaporate in its own heat. The days were still hot, but the evenings had begun to cool, the frigid hours after sunset claiming more of each day. Tyler had been gone a month. I was spending the afternoon with Grandma over in town. I'd had a bath that morning, even though it wasn't Sunday, and I'd put on special clothes with no holes or stains so that, scrubbed and polished, I could sit in Grandma's kitchen and watch her make pumpkin cookies. The autumn sun poured in through gossamer curtains and onto marigold tiles, giving the whole room an amber glow. After Grandma slid the first batch into the oven, I went to the bathroom. I passed through the hallway with its soft white carpet and felt a stab of anger when I remembered that the last time I'd seen it, I'd been with Tyler. The bathroom felt foreign. I took in the pearly sink, the rosy tint of the carpet, the peach-colored rug. Even the toilet peeked out from under a primrose covering. I took in my own reflection, framed by creamy tiles. I looked nothing like myself, and I wondered for a moment if this was what Tyler wanted. A pretty house with a pretty bathroom and a pretty sister to visit him. Maybe this was what he'd left for. I hated him for that. Near the tap were a dozen pink and white soaps, shaped like swans and roses, resting in an ivory-tinted shell. I picked up a swan, feeling its soft shape give under pressure from my fingers. It was beautiful, and I wanted to take it. I pictured it in our basement bathroom, its delicate wings set against the coarse cement. I imagined it lying in a muddy puddle on the sink, surrounded by strips of curling yellowed wallpaper. I returned it to its shell. Coming out, I walked into Grandma, who'd been waiting for me in the hall. "Did you wash your hands?" she asked, her tone sweet and buttery. "No," I said. My reply soured the cream in her voice. "Why not? They weren't dirty. You should always wash your hands after you use the toilet." "It can't be that important," I said. "We don't even have soap in the bathroom at home." "That's not true," she said. "I raised your mother better than that." I squared my stance, ready to argue, to tell Grandma again that we didn't use soap. But when I looked up, the woman I saw was not the woman I expected to see. She didn't seem frivolous, didn't seem like the type who'd waste an entire day fretting over her white carpet. In that moment, she was transformed. Maybe it was something in the shape of her eyes, the way they squinted at me in disbelief, or maybe it was the hard line of her mouth, which was clamped shut, determined. Or maybe it was nothing at all. Just the same old woman looking like herself and saying the things she always said. Maybe her transformation was merely a temporary shift in my perspective. For that moment, perhaps the perspective was his, that of the brother I hated and loved. Grandma led me into the bathroom and watched as I washed my hands, then directed me to dry them on the rose-colored towel. My ears burned. My throat felt hot. Dad picked me up soon after on his way home from a job. He pulled up in his truck and honked for me to come out, which I did, my head bent low. Grandma followed. I rushed into the passenger seat, displacing a toolbox and welding gloves, while Grandma told Dad about my not washing. Dad listened, sucking on his cheeks while his right hand fiddled with the gear shift. A laugh was bubbling up inside him. Having returned to my father, I felt the power of his person. A familiar lens slid over my eyes, and Grandma lost whatever strange power she'd had over me an hour before.
"Don't you teach your children to wash after they use the toilet?" Grandma said.
Dad shifted the truck into gear. As it rolled forward, he waved and said,
"I teach them not to piss on their hands."
Chapter 6 Shield and Buckler. The winter after Tyler left, Audrey turned 15. She picked up her driver's license from the county courthouse and, on her way home, got a job flipping burgers. Then she took a second job milking cows at 4 a.m. every morning. For a year, she'd been fighting with Dad, bucking under the restraints he put on her. Now she had money. She had her own car. We hardly saw her. The family was shrinking, the old hierarchy compressing. Dad didn't have enough of a crew to build hay sheds, so he went back to scrapping. With Tyler gone, the rest of us were promoted. Luke, at 16, became the eldest son, my father's right hand, and Richard and I took his place as grunts. I remember the first morning I entered the junkyard as one of my father's crew. The earth was ice. Even the air felt stiff. We were in the yard above the lower pasture, which was overrun by hundreds of cars and trucks. Some were old and broken down, but most had been wrecked, and they looked it. Bent, arched, twisted, the impression they gave was of crumpled paper, not steel. In the center of the yard, there was a lake of debris, vast and deep, leaking car batteries, tangles of insulated copper wire, abandoned transmissions, rusted sheets of corrugated tin, antique faucets, smashed radiators, serrated lengths of luminous brass pipe, and on. It was endless, a formless mass. Dad led me to its edge.
"You know the difference between aluminum and stainless steel?" he said.
"I think so."
"Come here."
His tone was impatient. He was used to dictating to grown men. Having to explain his trade to a 10-year-old girl somehow made us both feel small. He yanked out a chunk of shimmering metal.
"This here's aluminum," he said. "See how it shines? Feel how light it is?"
Dad put the piece into my hand. He was right. It was not as heavy as it looked. Next, Dad handed me a dented pipe.
"This here's steel," he said.
We began to sort the debris into piles. Aluminum, iron, steel, copper, so it could be sold. I picked up a piece of iron. It was dense with bronze rust, and its jagged angles nibbled at my palms. I had a pair of leather gloves, but when Dad saw them, he said they'd slow me down.
"You'll get calluses real quick,"
he promised as I handed them over. I'd found a hard hat in the shop, but Dad took that, too.
"You'll move slower trying to balance this silly thing on your head," he said.
Dad lived in fear of time. He felt it stalking him. I could see it in the worried glances he gave the sun as it moved across the sky, in the anxious way he appraised every length of pipe or cut of steel. Dad saw every piece of scrap as the money it could be sold for, minus the time needed to sort, cut, and deliver it. Every slab of iron, every ring of copper tubing was a nickel, a dime, a dollar. Less if it took more than 2 seconds to extract and classify. And he constantly weighed these meager profits against the hourly expense of running the house. He figured that to keep the lights on, the house warm, he needed to work at breakneck speed. I never saw Dad carry anything to a sorting bin. He just chucked it with all the strength he had from wherever he was standing. The first time I saw him do it, I thought it was an accident, a mishap that would be corrected. I hadn't yet grasped the rules of this new world. I had bent down and was reaching for a copper coil when something massive cut through the air next to me. When I turned to see where it had come from, I caught a steel cylinder full in the stomach. The impact knocked me to the ground.
"Oops!"
Dad hollered. I rolled over on the ice, winded. By the time I'd scrambled to my feet, Dad had launched something else. I ducked, but lost my footing and fell. This time, I stayed down. I was shaking, but not from the cold. My skin was alive and tingling with the certainty of danger, yet when I looked for the source of that danger, all I could see was a tired old man tugging on a broken light fixture. I remembered all the times I'd seen one of my brothers burst through the back door, howling, pinching some part of his body that was gashed or squashed or broken or burned. I remembered 2 years before when a man named Robert, who worked for Dad, had lost a finger. I remembered the otherworldly pitch of his scream as he ran to the house. I remembered staring at the bloody stump and then at the severed finger, which Luke brought in and placed on the counter. It looked like a prop from a magic trick. Mother put it on ice and rushed Robert to town so the doctors could sew it back on. Robert's was not the only finger the junkyard had claimed. A year before Robert, Sean's girlfriend, Emma, had come through the back door shrieking. She'd been helping Sean and lost half her index. Mother had rushed Emma to town, too, but the flesh had been crushed, and there was nothing they could do. I looked at my own pink fingers, and in that moment, the junkyard shifted. As children, Richard and I had passed countless hours in the debris, jumping from one mangled car to the next, looting some, leaving others. It had been the backdrop for 1,000 imagined battles between demons and wizards, fairies and goons, trolls and giants. Now it was changed. It had ceased to be my childhood playground and had become its own reality, one whose physical laws were mysterious, hostile. I was remembering the strange pattern the blood had made as it streaked down Emma's wrist, smearing across her forearm, when I stood and, still shaking, tried to pry loose the small length of copper tubing. I almost had it when Dad flung a catalytic converter. I leapt aside, cutting my hand on the serrated edge of a punctured tank. I wiped the blood on my jeans and shouted, "Don't throw them here! I'm here!" Dad looked up, surprised. He'd forgotten I was there. When he saw the blood, he walked over to me and put a hand on my shoulder.
"Don't worry, honey," he said. "God and his angels are here, working right alongside us. They won't let you be hurt."
I wasn't the only one whose feet were searching for solid ground. For 6 months after the car accident, Mother had improved steadily, and we'd thought she would fully recover. The headaches had become less frequent, so that she was shutting herself in the basement only 2 or 3 days a week. Then the healing had slowed. Now it had been 9 months. The headaches persisted, and Mother's memory was erratic. At least twice a week she'd ask me to cook breakfast, long after everyone had eaten and the dishes had been cleared. She'd tell me to weigh a pound of yarrow for a client, and I'd remind her that we'd delivered the yarrow the day before. She'd begin mixing a tincture, then a minute later couldn't remember which ingredients she'd added, so that the whole batch had to be tossed. Sometimes she would ask me to stand next to her and watch, so I could say, "You already added the lobelia. Next is the blue vervain." Mother began to doubt whether she would ever midwife again, and while she was saddened by this, Dad was devastated. His face sagged every time Mother turned a woman away.
"What if I have a migraine when she goes into labor?" she told him. "What if I can't remember what herbs I've given her, or the baby's heart rate?"
In the end, it wasn't Dad who convinced Mother to midwife again. She convinced herself, perhaps because it was a part of herself she couldn't surrender without some kind of struggle. That winter, she midwifed 2 babies that I remember. After the first, she came home sickly and pale, as if bringing that life into the world had taken a measure of her own. She was shut in the basement when the second call came. She drove to the berth in dark glasses, trying to peer through the waves distorting her vision. By the time she arrived, the headache was blinding, pulsing, driving out all thought. She locked herself in a back room, and her assistant delivered the baby. After that, Mother was no longer the midwife. On the next birth, she used the bulk of her fee to hire a second midwife to supervise her. Everyone was supervising her now, it seemed. She had been an expert, an uncontested power. Now, she had to ask her 10-year-old daughter whether she'd eaten lunch. That winter was long and dark, and I wondered if sometimes Mother was staying in bed even when she didn't have a migraine. At Christmas, someone gave her an expensive bottle of blended essential oils. It helped her headaches, but at $50 for a third of an ounce, we couldn't afford it. Mother decided to make her own. She began buying single, unmixed oils, eucalyptus and helichrysum, sandalwood and ravensara. And the house, which for years had smelled of earthy bark and bitter leaves, suddenly smelled of lavender and chamomile. She spent whole days blending oils, making adjustments to achieve specific fragrances and attributes. She worked with a pad and pen so she could record every step as she took it. The oils were much more expensive than the tinctures. It was devastating when she had to throw out a batch because she couldn't remember whether she'd added the spruce. She made an oil for migraines and an oil for menstrual cramps, one for sore muscles and one for heart palpitations. In the coming years, she would invent dozens more. To create her formulas, Mother took up something called muscle testing, which she explained to me as asking the body what it needs and letting it answer. Mother would say to herself aloud, "I have a migraine. What will make it better?" Then she would pick up a bottle of oil, press it to her chest, and with her eyes closed, say, "Do I need this?" If her body swayed forward, it meant yes, the oil would help her headache. If her body swayed backward, it meant no, and she would test something else. As she became more skilled, Mother went from using her whole body to only her fingers. She would cross her middle and index fingers, then flex slightly to try to uncross them, asking herself a question. If the fingers remained entwined, that meant yes. If they parted, it was no. The sound produced by this method was faint but unmistakable. Each time the pad of her middle finger slipped across the nail of her index, there was a fleshy click. Mother used muscle testing to experiment with other methods of healing. Diagrams of chakras and pressure points appeared around the house, and she began charging clients for something called energy work. I didn't know what that meant until one afternoon when Mother called me and Richard into the back room. A woman named Susan was there. Mother's eyes were closed, and her left hand was resting on Susan's. The fingers on her other hand were crossed, and she was whispering questions to herself. After a few, she turned to the woman and said, "Your relationship with your father is damaging your kidneys. Think of him while we adjust the chakra." Mother explained that energy work is most effective when several people are present. "So we can draw from everyone's energy," she said. Mother pointed to my forehead and told me to tap the center between my eyebrows, while with my other hand I was to grab Susan's arm. Richard was to tap a pressure point on his chest while reaching out to me with his other hand, and Mother was to hold a point in her palm while touching Richard with her foot. "That's it," she said as I took my brother's arm. We stood in silence for 10 minutes, a human chain. When I think of that afternoon, what I remember first is the awkwardness of it. Mother said she could feel the hot energy moving through our bodies, but I felt nothing. Mother and Richard stood still, eyes shut, breath shallow. They could feel the energy and were transported by it. I fidgeted. I tried to focus, then worried that I was ruining things for Susan, that I was a break in the chain, that Mother and Richard's healing power would never reach her because I was failing to conduct it. When the 10 minutes were up, Susan gave Mother $20, and the next customer came in. If I was skeptical, my skepticism was not entirely my fault. It was the result of my not being able to decide which of my mothers to trust. A year before the accident, when Mother had first heard of muscle testing and energy work, she'd dismissed both as wishful thinking. "People want a miracle," she'd told me. "They'll swallow anything if it brings them hope, if it lets them believe they're getting better. But there's no such thing as magic. Nutrition, exercise, and a careful study of herbal properties, that's all there is. But when they're suffering, people can't accept that." Now, Mother said that healing was spiritual and limitless. Muscle testing, she explained to me, was a kind of prayer, a divine supplication, an act of faith in which God spoke through her fingers. In some moments, I believed her, this wise woman with an answer to every question, but I could never quite forget the words of that other woman, that other mother, who was also wise. There's no such thing as magic. One day, Mother announced that she had reached a new skill level.
I no longer need to say the question aloud, she said. I can just think it.
That's when I began to notice Mother moving around the house, her hand resting lightly on various objects as she muttered to herself, her fingers flexing in a steady rhythm. If she was making bread and wasn't sure how much flour she'd added, click, click, click. If she was mixing oils and couldn't remember whether she'd added frankincense, click, click, click. She'd sit down to read her scriptures for 30 minutes, forget what time she'd started, then muscle test how long it had been. Click, click, click. Mother began to muscle test compulsively, unaware she was doing it, whenever she grew tired of a conversation, whenever the ambiguities of her memory, or even just those of normal life, left her unsatisfied. Her features would slacken, her face become vacant, and her fingers would click like crickets at dusk. Dad was rapturous.
Them doctors can't tell what's wrong just by touching you, he said, glowing. But Mother can.
The memory of Tyler haunted me that winter. I remembered the day he left, how strange it was to see his car bumping down the hill loaded with boxes. I couldn't imagine where he was now, but sometimes I wondered if perhaps school was less evil than Dad thought, because Tyler was the least evil person I knew, and he loved school, loved it more, it seemed, than he loved us. The seed of curiosity had been planted. It needed nothing more than time and boredom to grow. Sometimes, when I was stripping copper from a radiator or throwing the 500th chunk of steel into the bin, I'd find myself imagining the classrooms where Tyler was spending his days. My interest grew more acute with every deadening hour in the junkyard, until one day I had a bizarre thought, that I should enroll in the public school. Mother had always said we could go to school if we wanted. We just had to ask Dad, she said. Then we could go. But I didn't ask. There was something in the hard line of my father's face, in the quiet sigh of supplication he made every morning before he began family prayer, that made me think my curiosity was an obscenity, an affront to all he'd sacrificed to raise me. I made some effort to keep up my schooling in the free time I had between scrapping and helping Mother make tinctures and blend oils. Mother had given up homeschooling by then, but still had a computer, and there were books in the basement. I found the science book, with its colorful illustrations, and the math book I remembered from years before. I even located a faded green book of history. But when I sat down to study, I nearly always fell asleep. The pages were glossy and soft, made softer by the hours I'd spent hauling scrap. When Dad saw me with one of those books, he'd try to get me away from them. Perhaps he was remembering Tyler. Perhaps he thought if he could just distract me for a few years, the danger would pass. So he made up jobs for me to do, whether they needed doing or not. One afternoon, after he'd caught me looking at the math book, he and I spent an hour hauling buckets of water across the field to his fruit trees, which wouldn't have been at all unusual, except it was during a rainstorm. But if Dad was trying to keep his children from being overly interested in school and books, from being seduced by the Illuminati like Tyler had been, he would have done better to turn his attention to Richard. Richard was also supposed to spend his afternoons making tinctures for Mother, but he almost never did. Instead, he'd disappear. I don't know if Mother knew where he went, but I did. In the afternoons, Richard could nearly always be found in the dark basement, wedged in the crawl space between the couch and the wall, an encyclopedia propped open in front of him. If Dad happened by, he'd turn the light off, muttering about wasted electricity. Then I'd find some excuse to go downstairs so I could turn it back on. If Dad came through again, a snarl would sound through the house, and Mother would have to sit through a lecture on leaving lights on in empty rooms. She never scolded me, which makes me wonder if she did know where Richard was. If I couldn't get back down to turn on the light, Richard would pull the book to his nose and read in the dark. He wanted to read that badly. He wanted to read the encyclopedia that badly. Tyler was gone. There was hardly a trace he'd ever lived in the house, except one. Every night, after dinner, I would close the door to my room and pull Tyler's old boombox from under my bed. I dragged his desk into my room, and while the choir sang, I would settle into his chair and study, just as I'd seen him do on 1,000 nights. I didn't study history or math. I studied religion. I read the Book of Mormon twice. I read the New Testament, once quickly, then a second time more slowly, pausing to make notes, to cross-reference, and even to write short essays on doctrines like faith and sacrifice. No one read the essays. I wrote them for myself, the way I imagined Tyler had studied for himself and himself only. I worked through the Old Testament next. Then I read Dad's books, which were mostly compilations of the speeches, letters, and journals of the early Mormon prophets. Their language was of the 19th century, stiff, winding, but exact, and at first I understood nothing. But over time, my eyes and ears adjusted, so that I began to feel at home with those fragments of my people's history, stories of pioneers, my ancestors, striking out across the American wilderness. While the stories were vivid, the lectures were abstract, treatises on obscure philosophical subjects, and it was to these abstractions that I devoted most of my study. In retrospect, I see that this was my education, the one that would matter. The hours I spent sitting at a borrowed desk struggling to parse narrow strands of Mormon doctrine in mimicry of a brother who'd deserted me. The skill I was learning was a crucial one, the patience to read things I could not yet understand. By the time the snow on the mountain began to melt, my hands were thickly calloused. A season in the junkyard had honed my reflexes. I'd learned to listen for the low grunt that escaped Dad's lips whenever he tossed something heavy, and when I heard it, I hit the dirt. I spent so much time flat in the mud, I didn't salvage much. Dad joked I was as slow as molasses running uphill. The memory of Tyler had faded, and with it had faded his music, drowned out by the crack of metal crashing into metal. Those were the sounds that played in my head at night now, the jingle of corrugated tin, the short tap of copper wire, the thunder of iron. I had entered into the new reality. I saw the world through my father's eyes. I saw the angels, or at least I imagined I saw them, watching us scrap, stepping forward and catching the car batteries or jagged lengths of steel tubing that Dad launched across the yard. I'd stopped shouting at Dad for throwing them. Instead, I prayed. I worked faster when I salvaged alone, so one morning when Dad was in the northern tip of the yard, near the mountain, I headed for the southern tip, near the pasture. I filled a bin with 2,000 pounds of iron. Then, my arms aching, I ran to find Dad. The bin had to be emptied, and I couldn't operate the loader, a massive forklift with a telescopic arm and wide, black wheels that were taller than I was. The loader would raise the bin some 25 feet into the air, and then, with the boom extended, tilt the forks so the scrap could slide out, raining down into the trailer with a tremendous clamor. The trailer was a 50-foot flatbed rigged for scrapping, essentially a giant bucket. Its walls were made of thick iron sheets that reached 8 feet from the bed. The trailer could hold between 15 and 20 bins, or about 40,000 pounds of iron. I found Dad in the field, lighting a fire to burn the insulation from a tangle of copper wires. I told him the bin was ready, and he walked back with me and climbed into the loader. He waved at the trailer.
"We'll get more in if you settle the iron after it's been dumped. Hop in."
I didn't understand. He wanted to dump the bin with me in it?
I'll climb up after you've dumped the load, I said.
No, this'll be faster, Dad said. I'll pause when the bin's level with the trailer wall so you can climb out. Then you can run along the wall and perch on top of the cab until the dump is finished.
I settled myself on a length of iron. Dad jammed the forks under the bin, then lifted me and the scrap and began driving full throttle toward the trailer's head. I could barely hold on. On the last turn, the bucket swung with such force that a spike of iron was flung toward me. It pierced the inside of my leg, an inch below my knee, sliding into the tissue like a knife into warm butter. I tried to pull it out, but the load had shifted and it was partially buried. I heard the soft groaning of hydraulic pumps as the boom extended. The groaning stopped when the bin was level with the trailer. Dad was giving me time to climb onto the trailer wall, but I was pinned. I'm stuck, I shouted, only the growl of the loader's engine was too loud. I wondered if Dad would wait to dump the bin until he saw me sitting safely on the semi's cab, but even as I wondered, I knew he wouldn't. Time was still stalking. The hydraulics groaned, and the bin raised another 8 feet. Dumping position. I shouted again, higher this time, then lower, trying to find a pitch that would pierce through the drone of the engine. The bin began its tilt, slowly at first, then quickly. I was pinned near the back. I wrapped my hands around the bin's top wall, knowing this would give me a ledge to grasp when the bin was vertical. As the bin continued to pitch, the scrap at the front began to slide forward, bit by bit, a great iron glacier breaking apart. The spike was still embedded in my leg, dragging me downward. My grip had slipped, and I'd begun to slide when the spike finally ripped from me and fell away, smashing into the trailer with a tremendous crash. I was now free, but falling. I flailed my arms, willing them to seize something that wasn't plunging downward. My palm caught hold of the bin's sidewall, which was now nearly vertical. I pulled myself toward it and hoisted my body over its edge, then continued my fall. Because I was now falling from the side of the bin and not the front, I hoped, I prayed, that I was falling toward the ground and not toward the trailer, which was at that moment a fury of grinding metal. I sank, seeing only blue sky, waiting to feel either the stab of sharp iron or the jolt of solid earth. My back struck iron, the trailer's wall. My feet snapped over my head, and I continued my graceless plunge to the ground. The first fall was 7 or 8 feet, the second perhaps 10. I was relieved to taste dirt. I lay on my back for perhaps 15 seconds before the engine growled to silence, and I heard Dad's heavy step.
"What happened?"
he said, kneeling next to me.
"I fell out,"
I wheezed. The wind had been knocked out of me, and there was a powerful throbbing in my back as if I'd been cut in two.
"How'd you manage that?"
Dad said. His tone was sympathetic, but disappointed. I felt stupid. I should have been able to do it, I thought. It's a simple thing. Dad examined the gash in my leg, which had been ripped wide as the spike had fallen away. It looked like a pothole. The tissue had simply sunk out of sight. Dad slipped out of his flannel shirt and pressed it to my leg.
"Go on home," he said. "Mother will stop the bleeding."
I limped through the pasture until Dad was out of sight, then collapsed in the tall wheatgrass. I was shaking, gulping mouthfuls of air that never made it to my lungs. I didn't understand why I was crying. I was alive. I would be fine. The angels had done their part. So why couldn't I stop trembling? I was lightheaded when I crossed the last field and approached the house, but I burst through the back door as I'd seen my brothers do, as Robert and Emma had done, shouting for Mother. When she saw the crimson footprints streaked across the linoleum, she fetched the homeopathic she used to treat hemorrhages and shock, called Rescue Remedy, and put 12 drops of the clear, tasteless liquid under my tongue. She rested her left hand lightly on the gash and crossed the fingers of her right. Her eyes closed. Click, click, click.
"There's no tetanus," she said. "The wound will close.
eventually, but it'll leave a nasty scar. She turned me onto my stomach and examined the bruise, a patch of deep purple the size of a human head that had formed a few inches above my hip. Again, her fingers crossed and her eyes closed. Click, click, click.
"You've damaged your kidney," she said. "We'd better make a fresh batch of juniper and mullein flower."
The gash below my knee had formed a scab, dark and shiny, a black river flowing through pink flesh, when I came to a decision. I chose a Sunday evening, when Dad was resting on the couch, his Bible propped open in his lap. I stood in front of him for what felt like hours, but he didn't look up, so I blurted out what I'd come to say.
"I want to go to school."
He seemed not to have heard me.
"I've prayed, and I want to go," I said.
Finally, Dad looked up, and straight ahead, his gaze fixed on something behind me. The silence settled, its presence heavy.
"In this family," he said, "we obey the commandments of the Lord."
He picked up his Bible, and his eyes twitched as they jumped from line to line. I turned to leave, but before I reached the doorway, Dad spoke again.
"You remember Jacob and Esau?"
"I remember," I said.
He returned to his reading, and I left quietly. I did not need any explanation. I knew what the story meant. It meant that I was not the daughter he had raised, the daughter of faith. I had tried to sell my birthright for a mess of pottage. Chapter 7. The Lord Will Provide. It was a rainless summer. The sun blazed across the sky each afternoon, scorching the mountain with its arid, desiccating heat, so that each morning, when I crossed the field to the barn, I felt stalks of wild wheat crackle and break beneath my feet. I spent an amber morning making the rescue remedy homeopathic for Mother. I would take 15 drops from the base formula, which was kept in Mother's sewing cupboard, where it would not be used or polluted, and add them to a small bottle of distilled water. Then I would make a circle with my index finger and my thumb and push the bottle through the circle. The strength of the homeopathic, Mother said, depended on how many passes the bottle made through my fingers, how many times it drew on my energy. Usually I stopped at 50. Dad and Luke were on the mountain, in the junkyard above the upper pasture, a quarter mile from the house. They were preparing cars for the crusher, which Dad had hired for later that week. Luke was 17. He had a lean, muscular build and, when outdoors, an easy smile. Luke and Dad were draining gasoline from the tanks. The crusher won't take a car with the fuel tank attached because there's a risk of explosion, so every tank had to be drained and removed. It was slow work, puncturing the tank with a hammer and stake, then waiting for the fuel to drip out so the tank could be safely removed with a cutting torch. Dad had devised a shortcut, an enormous skewer, 8 feet tall, of thick iron. Dad would lift a car with the forklift, and Luke would guide him until the car's tank was suspended directly over the spike. Then Dad would drop the forks. If all went well, the car would be impaled on the spike, and gasoline would gush from the tank, streaming down the spike and into the flat-bottom container Dad had welded in place to collect it. By noon, they had drained somewhere between 30 and 40 cars. Luke had collected the fuel in 5-gallon buckets, which he began to haul across the yard to Dad's flatbed. On one pass, he stumbled, drenching his jeans in a gallon of gas. The summer sun dried the denim in a matter of minutes. He finished hauling the buckets, then went home for lunch. I remember that lunch with unsettling clarity. I remember the clammy smell of beef and potato casserole and the jingle of ice cubes tumbling into tall glasses which sweated in the summer heat. I remember Mother telling me I was on dish duty because she was leaving for Utah after lunch to consult for another midwife on a complicated pregnancy. She said she might not make it home for dinner, but there was hamburger in the freezer. I remember laughing the whole hour. Dad lay on the kitchen floor, cracking jokes about an ordinance that had recently passed in our little farming village. A stray dog had bitten a boy, and everyone was up in arms. The mayor had decided to limit dog ownership to 2 dogs per family, even though the attacking dog hadn't belonged to anybody at all.
"These genius socialists," Dad said. "They'd drown staring up at the rain if you didn't build a roof over them."
I laughed so hard at that, my stomach ached. Luke had forgotten all about the gasoline by the time he and Dad walked back up the mountain and readied the cutting torch, but when he jammed the torch into his hip and struck flint to steel, flames burst from the tiny spark and engulfed his leg. The part we would remember, would tell and retell so many times it became family folklore, was that Luke was unable to get out of his gasoline-soaked jeans. That morning, like every morning, he had hitched up his trousers with a yard of baling twine, which is smooth and slippery and needs a horseman's knot to stay in place. His footwear didn't help either, bulbous steel-toed boots so tattered that for weeks he'd been duct-taping them on each morning, then cutting them off each night with his pocket knife. Luke might have severed the twine and hacked through the boots in a matter of seconds, but he went mad with panic and took off, dashing like a marked buck, spreading fire through the sagebrush and wheatgrass, which were baked and brittle from the parched summer. I'd stacked the dirty dishes and was filling the kitchen sink when I heard it, a shrill, strangled cry that began in one key and ended in another. There was no question it was human. I'd never heard an animal bellow like that, with such fluctuations in tone and pitch. I ran outside and saw Luke hobbling across the grass. He screamed for mother, then collapsed. That's when I saw that the jeans on his left leg were gone, melted away. Parts of the leg were livid, red and bloody. Others were bleached and dead. Papery ropes of skin wrapped delicately around his thigh and down his calf, like wax dripping from a cheap candle. His eyes rolled back in his head. I bolted back into the house. I packed the new bottles of rescue remedy, but the base formula still sat on the counter. I snatched it and ran outside, then dumped half the bottle between Luke's twitching lips. There was no change. His eyes were marble white. One brown iris slipped into view, then the other. He began to mumble, then to scream. "It's on fire! It's on fire!" he roared. A chill passed through him, and his teeth clattered. He was shivering. I was only 10, and in that moment I felt very much a child. Luke was my big brother. I thought he would know what to do, so I grabbed his shoulders and shook him, hard. "Should I make you cold or make you hot?" I shouted. He answered with a gasp. The burn was the injury, I reasoned. It made sense to treat it first. I fetched a pack of ice from the chest freezer on the patio, but when the pack touched his leg, he screamed, a back-arching, eye-popping scream that made my brain claw at my skull. I needed another way to cool the leg. I considered unloading the chest freezer and putting Luke inside it, but the freezer would only work if the lid was shut, and then he'd suffocate. I mentally searched the house. We had a large garbage can, a blue whale of a bin. It was splattered with bits of rotted food, so rank we kept it shut away in a closet. I sprinted into the house and emptied it onto the linoleum, noting the dead mouse Richard had tossed in the day before. Then I carried the bin outside and sprayed it out with the garden hose. I knew I should clean it more thoroughly, maybe with dish soap, but looking at Luke, the way he was writhing on the grass, I didn't feel I had time. With the last bit of slop blasted away, I righted the bin and filled it with water. Luke was scrambling toward me to put his leg in when I heard an echo of my mother's voice. She was telling someone that the real worry with a burn isn't the damaged tissue, but infection. "Luke!" I shouted. "Don't! Don't put your leg in!" He ignored me and continued crawling toward the bin. He had a cold look in his eye that said nothing mattered except the fire burning from his leg into his brain. I moved quickly. I shoved the bin, and a great wave of water heaved over the grass. Luke made a gargled noise, as if he were choking. I ran back into the kitchen and found the bags that fit the can, then held one open for Luke and told him to put his leg in. He didn't move, but he allowed me to pull the bag over the raw flesh. I righted the can and stuffed the garden hose inside. While the bin filled, I helped Luke balance on one foot and lower his burned leg, now wrapped in black plastic, into the garbage can. The afternoon air was sweltering. The water would warm quickly. I tossed in the pack of ice. It didn't take long, 20 minutes, maybe 30, before Luke seemed in his right mind, calm and able to prop himself up. Richard wandered up from the basement. The garbage can was smack in the middle of the lawn, 10 feet from any shade, and the afternoon sun was strong. Full of water, the can was too heavy for us to move, and Luke refused to take out his leg, even for a minute. I fetched a straw sombrero Grandma had given us in Arizona. Luke's teeth were still chattering, so I also brought a wool blanket. And there he stood, a sombrero on his head, a wool blanket around his shoulders, and his leg in a garbage can. He looked something between homeless and on vacation. The sun warmed the water. Luke began to shift uncomfortably. I returned to the chest freezer, but there was no more ice, just a dozen bags of frozen vegetables, so I dumped them in. The result was a muddy soup with bits of peas and carrots. Dad wandered home sometime after this. I couldn't say how long. A gaunt, defeated look on his face. Quiet now, Luke was resting, or as near to resting as he could be standing up. Dad wheeled the bin into the shade because, despite the hat, Luke's hands and arms had turned red with sunburn. Dad said the best thing to do was leave the leg where it was until Mother came home. Mother's car appeared on the highway around 6. I met her halfway up the hill and told her what had happened. She rushed to Luke and said she needed to see the leg, so he lifted it out, dripping. The plastic bag clung to the wound. Mother didn't want to tear the fragile tissue, so she cut the bag away slowly, carefully, until the leg was visible. There was very little blood, and even fewer blisters, as both require skin, and Luke didn't have much. Mother's face turned a grayish yellow, but she was calm. She closed her eyes and crossed her fingers, then asked aloud whether the wound was infected. Click, click, click.
"You were lucky this time, Tara," she said. "But what were you thinking putting a burn into a garbage can?"
Dad carried Luke inside, and Mother fetched her scalpel. It took her and Dad most of the evening to cut away the dead flesh. Luke tried not to scream, but when they pried up and stretched bits of his skin, trying to see where the dead flesh ended and the living began, he exhaled in great gusts, and tears slid from his eyes. Mother dressed the leg in mullein and comfrey salve, her own recipe. She was good with burns, they were a specialty of hers, but I could tell she was worried. She said she'd never seen one as bad as Luke's. She didn't know what would happen. Mother and I stayed by Luke's bed that first night. He barely slept, he was so delirious with fever and pain. For the fever, we put ice on his face and chest. For the pain, we gave him lobelia, blue vervain, and skullcap. This was another of Mother's recipes. I'd taken it after I'd fallen from the scrap bin to dull the throbbing in my leg while I waited for the gash to close, but as near as I could tell, it had no effect. I believed hospital drugs were an abomination to God, but if I'd had morphine that night, I'd have given it to Luke. The pain robbed him of breath. He lay propped up in his bed, beads of sweat falling from his forehead onto his chest, holding his breath until he turned red, then purple, as if depriving his brain of oxygen was the only way he could make it through the next minute. When the pain in his lungs overtook the pain of the burn, he would release the air in a great, gasping cry, a cry of relief for his lungs, of agony for his leg. I tended him alone the second night so Mother could rest. I slept lightly, waking at the first sounds of fussing, at the slightest shifting of weight, so I could fetch the ice and tinctures before Luke became fully conscious and the pain gripped him. On the third night, Mother tended him, and I stood in the doorway, listening to his gasps, watching Mother watch him, her face hollow, her eyes swollen with worry and exhaustion. When I slept, I dreamed. I dreamed about the fire I hadn't seen. I dreamed it was me lying in that bed, my body wrapped in loose bandages, mummified. Mother knelt on the floor beside me, pressing my plastered hand the way she pressed Luke's, dabbing my forehead, praying. Luke didn't go to church that Sunday, or the Sunday after that, or the one after that. Dad told us to tell people Luke was sick. He said there'd be trouble if the government found out about Luke's leg, that the feds would take us kids away, that they would put Luke in a hospital where his leg would get infected and he would die. About 3 weeks after the fire, Mother announced that the skin around the edges of the burn had begun to grow back and that she had hope for even the worst patches. By then, Luke was sitting up, and a week later, when the first cold spell hit, he could stand for a minute or two on crutches. Before long, he was thumping around the house, thin as a string bean, swallowing buckets of food to regain the weight he'd lost. By then, the twine was a family fable.
"A man ought to have a real belt," Dad said at breakfast on the day Luke was well enough to return to the junkyard, handing him a leather strap with a steel buckle. "Not Luke," Richard said. "He prefers twine. You know how fashionable he is."
Luke grinned.
"Beauty's everything," he said.
For 18 years, I never thought of that day, not in any probing way. The few times my reminiscing carried me back to that torrid afternoon, what I remembered first was the belt. "Luke," I would think, "you wild dog. I wonder, do you still wear twine?" Now, at age 29, I sit down to write, to reconstruct the incident from the echoes and shouts of a tired memory. I scratch it out. When I get to the end, I pause. There's an inconsistency, a ghost in this story. I read it. I read it again. And there it is. Who put out the fire? A long dormant voice says, "Dad did." But Luke was alone when I found him. If Dad had been with Luke on the mountain, he would have brought him to the house, would have treated the burn. Dad was away on a job somewhere. That's why Luke had had to get himself down the mountain, why his leg had been treated by a 10-year-old, why it had ended up in a garbage can. I decide to ask Richard. He's older than I and has a sharper memory. Besides, last I heard, Luke no longer has a telephone. I call. The first thing Richard remembers is the twine, which, true to his nature, he refers to as a baling implement. Next, he remembers the spilled gasoline. I ask how Luke managed to put out the fire and get himself down the mountain, given that he was in shock when I found him. "Dad was with him," Richard says flatly. Right. Then why wasn't Dad at the house? Richard says, because Luke had run through the weeds and set the mountain afire. You remember that summer. Dry, scorching. You can't go starting forest fires in farm country during a dry summer. So Dad put Luke in the truck and told him to drive to the house, to Mother. Only Mother was gone. Right. I think it over for a few days, then sit back down to write. Dad is there in the beginning. Dad with his funny jokes about socialists and dogs and the roof that keeps liberals from drowning. Then Dad and Luke go back up the mountain. Mother drives away, and I turn the tap to fill the kitchen sink. Again, for the third time, it feels like. On the mountain, something is happening. I can only imagine it, but I see it clearly, more clearly than if it were a memory. The cars are stacked and waiting, their fuel tanks ruptured and drained. Dad waves at a tower of cars and says, "Luke, cut off those tanks, yeah?" And Luke says, "Sure thing, Dad." He lays the torch against his hip and strikes flint. Flames erupt from nowhere and take him. He screams, fumbles with the twine, screams again, and takes off through the weeds. Dad chases him, orders him to stand still. It's probably the first time in his whole life that Luke doesn't do something when Dad is telling him to. Luke is fast, but Dad is smart. He takes a shortcut through a pyramid of cars and tackles Luke, slamming him to the ground. I can't picture what happens next because nobody ever told me how Dad put out the fire on Luke's leg. Then, a memory surfaces of Dad that night in the kitchen, wincing as Mother slathers salve on his hands, which are red and blistering. And I know what he must have done. Luke is no longer on fire. I try to imagine the moment of decision. Dad looks at the weeds, which are burning fast, thirsty for flame in that quivering heat. He looks at his son. He thinks if he can choke the flames while they're young, he can prevent a wildfire, maybe save the house. Luke seems lucid. His brain hasn't processed what's happened. The pain hasn't set in. The Lord will provide, I imagine Dad thinking. God left him conscious. I imagine Dad praying aloud, his eyes drawn heavenward as he carries his son to the truck and sets him in the driver's seat. Dad shifts the engine into first. The truck starts its roll. It's going at a good speed now. Luke is gripping the wheel. Dad jumps from the moving truck, hits the ground hard and rolls, then runs back toward the brush fire, which has spread wider and grown taller. The Lord will provide, he chants. Then he takes off his shirt and begins to beat back the flames. Since the writing of this story, I have spoken to Luke about the incident. His account differs from both mine and Richard's. In Luke's memory, Dad took Luke to the house, administered a homeopathic for shock, then put him in a tub of cold water, where he left him to go fight the fire. This goes against my memory and against Richard's. Still, perhaps our memories are in error. Perhaps I found Luke in a tub, alone, rather than on the grass. What everyone agrees on, strangely, is that somehow Luke ended up on the front lawn, his leg in a garbage can. Chapter 8. Tiny Harlots. I wanted to get away from the junkyard, and there was only one way to do that, which was the way Audrey had done it, by getting a job so I wouldn't be at the house when Dad rounded up his crew. The trouble was, I was 11. I biked a mile into the dusty center of our little village. There wasn't much there, just a church, a post office, and a gas station called Papa J's. I went into the post office. Behind the counter was an older lady whose name I knew as Myrna Moyle. Because Myrna and her husband Jay, Papa Jay, owned the gas station. They'd been behind the city ordinance limiting dog ownership to 2 dogs per family. They'd proposed other ordinances too. And now, every Sunday, Dad came home from church shouting about Myrna and Jay Moyle and how they were from Monterey or Seattle or wherever and thought they could impose West Coast socialism on the good people of Idaho. I asked Myrna if I could put a card up on the board. She asked what the card was for. I said I hoped I could find jobs babysitting. What times are you available? She said. Anytime. All the time. You mean after school? I mean all the time. Myrna looked at me and tilted her head. My daughter Mary needs someone to tend her youngest. I'll ask her. Mary taught nursing at the school, which Dad said was just about as brainwashed as a person could get, to be working for the medical establishment and the government both. I thought maybe he wouldn't let me work for her, but he did. And pretty soon I was babysitting Mary's daughter every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. Then Mary had a friend, Eve, who needed a babysitter for her 3 children on Tuesdays and Thursdays. A mile down the road, a man named Randy ran a business out of his home, selling cashews, almonds, and macadamias. He stopped by the post office one afternoon and chatted with Myrna about how tired he was of packing the boxes himself, how he wished he could hire some kids, but they were all tied up with football and band. "There's at least one kid in this town who isn't," Myrna said, "and I think she'd be real eager." She pointed to my card, and soon I was babysitting from 8 until noon, Monday to Friday, then going to Randy's to pack cashews until supper. I wasn't paid much, but as I'd never been paid anything before, it felt like a lot. People at church said Mary could play the piano beautifully. They used the word professional. I didn't know what that meant until one Sunday when Mary played a piano solo for the congregation. The music stopped my breath. I'd heard the piano played countless times before to accompany